After an amazing 2 weeks of Paralympic sport, RNIB Connect Radio held a post-Paralympic celebration at RNIB's head office in London to recognise the extraordinary contribution from blind and partially sighted athletes to sport and the wider discourse around living with sight loss. This radio show was recorded in front of a live audience, and we were thrilled to have on our panel javelin gold medalist and world record holder Dan Pembroke, swimmer Scarlett Humphrey and her twin sister swimmer Eliza Humphrey, and the CEO of Paralympics GB, David Clark. RNIB's own Alan Russell is your host, and here's Matt Stringer, RNIB's CEO, starting the event.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming along. My name is Matt Stringer. I'm the CEO of the RNIB. So great to have you here this afternoon up on the third floor of our newish office at Grimaldi Building in London. And a few words from me, but really I'm the hors d'oeuvre before the main course of Alan and a bevy of Paralympians who are going to entertain you this afternoon and talk about the brilliant achievements of the last 10 days or so. And I think we're also here to celebrate, you know, the sport in general and the power it has to unite people and cultures around the world. I think, like all of us, I've been sort of transfixed by the Paralympics in the last 10 days. I felt a real sense of pride watching our athletes compete. 124 medals achieved, including 49 gold. USA in third place. I wasn't disappointed about that. We're going to get on to the athletes in a minute. I mean, there are too many athletes and medalists to mention across 125 medals achieved. Just want to pick a couple with reference to the visually impaired athletes. First of all, somebody RNIB you know well, good friend of ours, Stephen Clegg. Two goals, world record in swimming in the S12 men's butterfly and backstroke. And he did a great RNIB interview with our own Toby Davey, which we put out on social media last week. He spoke very movingly about the number of VI athletes being underrepresented in parasports and talked very, very well about his own job of getting more people involved and taking, you know, he called it the responsibility to encourage people to follow their passions, and how swimming was a huge factor in helping him with some of his sort of challenges as he was moving through the cycle into Paris. And from an RNIB perspective, in the visually impaired perspective, believe it or not, blind and partially sighted people are twice as likely to be inactive as sighted people. And this isn't due to lack of desire, but it's due to systemic and attitudinal barriers that exist in society. Accessibility, awareness, cost, confidence, and transportation are all key barriers, and that doesn't just apply to playing sport, it's watching it too. You know, with blind and partially sighted people, half as likely to attend live sporting events compared to the average across the UK. So the RNIB are on a bit of a mission to change this. Our strategic objectives for sport and physical activity fall into two main areas. First, we want to see more blind and partially sighted people active and involved in sport and physical activity. Secondly, we want to raise public awareness of sight loss through sport. We want to see social change by leveraging major moments like the Paralympics, which help shine a spotlight on people with sight loss and how simple adaptations enable blind and partially sighted people to access the same opportunities as everyone else. We're here today to honour the Paralympians. In front of you, we have Dan Pembroke, two world records and a gold medal, and just told me, picked out by journalists as their sporting highlight of the Games. We've got Eliza and Scarlett Humphrey, who all made finals in a raft of races in the swimming pool. And I'm also thrilled, seriously, that David Clark is here. He's been a great servant to the RNIB over many years. Brilliant. He moved on sort of 18 months or so ago to the role of CEO of British Paralympic Association. And I think has obviously led that organisation with skill and aplomb through the last 10 days of Paris to have a record achievement in terms of medals and the number of golds up on Tokyo. There are loads of young, visually impaired people out there who would love to follow in the footsteps of the Paralympians who stand in front of us today. So let's go make it happen, and let's work together to break down barriers and build opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. Welcome, everyone. My name's Alan Russell. I'm a senior content producer with RNIB Connect Radio, and I had the privilege of going with the guys from the station out to Paris to cover these games. We had live shows. We were recording interviews at the events themselves, and it's nice actually to be here with the guys, some of the guys sitting beside us, to ask them some more in-depth questions. Let's start with just a little bit of an overview of some of the guys who are beside me. We have Dan Pembroke. He began throwing a javelin in secondary school before joining his local club, found success at the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games, where he set a new Paralympic record of 69.52 metres, which is pretty impressive. That was a gold-winning throw, then completed the set as reigning European, Paralympic and world champion with the season's best of 75.5 metres ahead of the Paris Games. He successfully retained that championship title during the year in Japan and broke the world record twice in Paris, winning gold. And we've got the young team next. We've got 19-year-old twins. We've got Eliza and Scarlett Humphrey. Lovely to have you guys here with us as well. They took part in their first ever Paralympic Games, debutantes. I think there were 81 debutantes at the game, in fact, this year for Paralympics GB. It was their first taste of swimming came when their parents took them to a learn to swim class. So that's how easy it can begin. And a British Blind Sports Swimming Gala signposted them to Northampton Swimming Club, where they began swimming competitively. So Eliza is a double European medalist, securing both her medals at the 2024 Championships in Madeira, competing there. And Scarlett is a world bronze winning medalist, securing her maiden international medal as part of the mixed 4x100 metres relay team at the 2022 Championships in Madeira. And both of them made it to the finals of a range of races in Paris, and we are really pleased to have them here. So Eliza and Scarlett, round of applause for you guys as well. And last but by no means least, we've got David Clark with us, the Chief Executive of the British Paralympic Association and a former international blind footballer himself. A record goal scorer, I think, David, and five golden boots, I think it is to your name. 2 feet, correct. But five golden boots.
No Paralympic medals for me, though.
And a round of applause for all our guests. So let's start things off then chatting with David, actually, for, I suppose, David, a bit of an overview of the games. The dust has almost settled now, and we know it was very successful. Your first Paralympics in charge of the BPA as well. So, you know, what do you look back on now?
Well, first of all, I think it was an incredible Paralympic Games. I think Paris and France deserves all the credit. We felt what it was like in London back all 12 years ago, but we also knew that we needed to kind of move on from London and we needed to see things move forward. And I think Tokyo would have been that Games, but unfortunately through COVID it had to be a fan-free Games. So it was just wonderful to experience it in an amazing city. The people really bought into it, the stadiums were full, and it was incredible. The second thing is our athletes. I mean, the performances of our athletes were incredible. You know, we talk about the 124 medals, but as is proof of here today with Scarlett and Eliza, there were many, many more aspects to our performance than medals. And it was brilliant to see so many debutants coming through. It was brilliant to see the stewardship of many of those debutants through some of our very senior athletes who had multiple games behind them. But it's also opportune to mention the team behind the team. You know, we had a delegation of 650 people out in Paris that included 215 athletes. But there were so many people supporting the team and behind the team and making it happen. And I just feel very privileged to have this role. I feel very privileged also about what I learned when I was at RNIB, because I think our 50th gold medal was what we achieved off the field of play in terms of the Equal Play campaign and the government interaction and the government support for that campaign. And I think I learned a lot of those skills about how to do this stuff in my 4.5 years at RNIB. So a really super Games and a really long answer. Sorry, Al.
Sorry, we're used to it. I just can't edit this one yet. Let's chat to the athletes then. I'm going to sort of ask you guys a bit about, you know, getting into sport and what that means to you. But first of all, I want to just take you back to the Games, which wasn't that long ago. So, Dan, so first of all, you're throwing the javelin. What's it like stepping out with your Paralympics GB kit on into that arena? The crowd are there.
Yeah, this was something totally different. You'll have to excuse my voice today because I've been partying way too hard. Yes, it was incredible to have GB kit on and having a crowd applaud me as I walk out there. And obviously, being in France, we had so many people from the UK cheering on. Saw so many GB flags in the audience, and it was that moment that I knew that that would be my superpower, and to propel that javelin to 74.49 metres. So, yeah, it was awesome.
Eliza and Scarlett, you're both competing in the pool. Eliza, first of all, what was it like stepping out in that arena? Because the crowds are closer to you there.
Yeah, it was incredible. The crowds are really, really loud. And I was racing on day two, so everyone's like, oh, be prepared for the crowd. It'll be an amazing experience when you step out. And it truly was, because when they read your name out, when you came out in the final, just the stadium seemed to erupt because we had so many people supporting, like just from GB who came. It felt like almost a home Paralympics because so many people have travelled, but also because the crowds are supporting every athlete, like regardless of country. So they're just cheering for everyone. So to have that support for para sport and for the swimming was just incredible, an incredible feeling. And for that, it just motivated me to swim even harder, to just make everyone proud of what they were watching.
Scarlett, what about you? Was it similar for you? Was there anything different about being there with the crowds roaring the first time you stepped out?
I think at first it was a bit of a shock because I wasn't really expecting it. We don't usually get that much support for para swimming. So it's something I've never experienced before, but I really did enjoy it. And I loved the energy that the crowd gave to the swimming. I really do think it pushed the swimmers on to that next level. And so much energy and support that that's what you want. You want to train hard to swim well for people to want to come and watch or want to see world-class swimming.
Dan, when you're preparing to go out, do you have a routine you go through, or do you like to focus out the crowd? How do you prepare yourself to throw the javelin?
I try and distract myself as much as possible, visualising something else, like a happy place, something else. So we play a lot of games with the other athletes. This time around, I got named team captain for the para athletics team. So that was really nice, and managed to get every single one of the athletes playing different games. Taking your mind away from such a spectacle event is really refreshing, because then when you go out there, you take it all in.
Eliza, what about you?
Before racing, I generally just stay relaxed. So yeah, we had some games that we had in the lead up to going to the village. So in the holding camp, and where we could access when we're in the village. So we just played like Scrabble and things against other athletes and coaches. That was good fun.
Scarlett, what about you? Do you play games? Do you do anything particular before you go out there?
As I said, in the holding camp, we were in London a week before going to Paris as a team, as British Aquatics GB. So we had some games like Scrabble, Bop It. So there was a Connect Four, there was a PlayStation, Nintendo, Switch. So I was relaxed going into Paris. But in the cool room itself, even though I've been racing internationally now for about 3 years, I still like get a little bit giddy that all the international athletes are in my heat, going, oh, there's like seven different countries in this heat. So yeah, I quite like just sitting there taking in that there's many, many nations in this cool room.
I mean, it doesn't sound like nerves really come into it at all. Dan, would that be fair for you, or do you get a bit nervous?
Oh no, definitely. Maybe a week out, I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling it, you know, because I'm watching other athletes go out before me, because I'm often one of the last athletes to go out there and do my thing. So I kind of get an idea of what I'm about to walk out on. And that's when I become nervous. Then 4 days out, I'm switching off. And then I'm kind of really refreshed to when I'm going out to the track.
And Scarlett, what about you? Do you get nerves at all?
Yeah, no, I do. I do get very nervous. I think, yeah, it starts at like a few days out that if I overthink it a little bit, I do feel the nerves. If I think of, oh, I want to get this time. But on race day itself, I think once I'm in the cool room, I'm nervous, but also trying to channel that energy and adrenaline into the race. So you just, once you're in on race day, you're just going through the processes of warming up, keeping warm, and then going to the cool room. So you haven't got time to think of the race itself. You're just going through the processes before it, so you don't have the time for the nerves to sink in.
The thing that I got from talking to a lot of the athletes out there was having friends and family in the crowd. For everyone, it was a huge boost to them to know they were there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my wife, who's here in the audience today, Martina, my cousin, my other friends as well, and they all had like face paints on their faces and looked ridiculous, but it made me laugh. And yeah, to have them there and literally like on the last throw that I done, they came right down to the front and I got the crowd going, and I felt at one with like 65,000 people in that stadium from all nationalities wishing me to do well. And I unleashed the sixth throw. I knew it would land around sort of like 60, 65 meters. And I just thought, I'm running over this line and going in the middle of the crowd and in the middle of the field and soaking up the crowd. And then I ran back to Martina and gave her a big old hug and a little bit of a cry.
Eliza, is it similar? I mean, the crowd are so close to you there, and your friends and family are there as well. Do you notice them when you're competing? Do you know they're there?
Yeah, Gav and I were lucky to have all our family came out, and then some of our friends and other people we know came out to watch. So that was really, really special. And then I could just hear the roar from the crowd, really. And then when I was collecting my stuff after the race, that's when I really heard like the people we knew, because if they were near the front, that's when I was like, oh, yay, the people who have come and watched are obviously happy with how we did.
And Scarlett, do you kind of use that noise, the friends and family are there, does that push you further?
Yeah, I think it does. It's a loud roar when you walk out, but then sometimes you do hear, like, tune in on hearing people shouting your name, and you're like, oh, there's people out there who, like, really want me to do well. So sometimes I did hear, like, my parents or my friends shouting. So I just gave them a thumbs up. Knowing that they're there, I think, is extra special, because it's the people that mean so much to you and who have put so much aside for you to allow you to do the sport, to get you to this level. So my parents, they have to drive me everywhere and they come to all my competitions. And like friends have to make, like when I'm away at weekends, I have to go on hold sometimes if I'm away. I'm like, sorry, I'm not available. But having them there is extra special because they've been on this journey with me as well.
That's quite interesting about, you know, I suppose your friends and family. We think they're just there to cheer you on, but yeah, they're part of that journey, Dan, as you say, as Scott and Eliza allude to there. You know, they're part of getting you where you are.
Yeah, I mean, Martina would probably tell you this one as well, that, you know, throughout the journey, it's not easy. You know, I've been riddled with injuries since, you know, after Tokyo, and really struggled each year. And not really competing many times. But, you know, it's always the bad times that make the good times good. And, you know, without all those struggles, you don't have a gauge on how hard it is to get to that start line. And, you know, like from the start of this year, 1st of January, I tore my hamstring, right? It was sort of like I was ready for the new year, and then bang, in the training session, tore my hamstring. And then in May, just before the World Championships, I tore my soleus in my calf. You know, I was just thinking, wow, does anything else want to happen here? Yeah, I think all those things, the bad times make the good times good. And Martina is there to witness every single thing that I go through and the ups and downs. So having her there, she really grounds me, which is a nice feeling when you're up so high.
That's such an amazing thing to say. David, they talked about family here as well, but I suppose the Paralympics GB is a family. You know, hearing from the guys here, it's not just that their relatives and their friends coming out to see them. There's that whole support there, not just the physical training, there's the psychological support, nutrition. It's a team, but it's a family.
Yeah, as I say, the total delegation at its maximum is about 650, and that's all sorts of environments. So first of all, we got all the prep camps, and, you know, we had lots of people prepping in the UK. We had a massive prep camp at Saint-Germain-en-Laye, just outside Paris. We had people coming in from Hungary and Germany and all over the place. So those camps had to be look like Paralympics GB. We're trying to set up a multi-sport environment where we're one team. So in terms of the branding and the feel and the food and everything attached to it, it was really important.
Was that food as well? Saint-Germain.
Our chef apparently in Saint-Germain-en-Laye was the best chef available. So Dan made the most of it, as well as telling the Prime Minister what he should do. So
my last meal coming out of the holding camp was a ribeye steak. I mean, that's looking after you, isn't it?
That's athlete food, if ever there was. So it's really important we did that. And then, of course, at the Games, you know, we got the village where, you know, if anyone didn't see our building at the village, I mean, you could see it from everywhere, and the branding. And also we had the field. So we had something familiar to people at RNIB. We had Navilens both in our prep camps and in our kitting out and in our building in the Games, so people could, blind or visually impaired could you get a sense of where they were and the kind of things that were on the walls and that kind of thing. And then we had our house, and that's where we had friends and family coming through. We had all of our media. And one of the most amazing things at that was, you know, when our medalists came through to do their media and then met their friends and family, they then came down and did, you know, the walk down to the bell, and they put their signed their medals and put them on the board and went and rang the bell. And there was just a brilliant atmosphere of all the volunteers and the friends and family and our staff, you know, sort of paving the way to do that. It just hopefully made them feel very special. But for us, as Paralympics GB, pulling together a multi-sport team who are, you know, one team, team behaviours, winning well mentality, really, really important for us to create that culture where we're all doing it together, we're all doing it for each other. And I have to say, in every environment, I was just so impressed with how all of our team members right across the delegation conducted themselves. It was just a privilege to be there.
When we were talking with the athletes after the performances or at GB House, what I found strange, that few of the athletes I spoke to, medal-winning athletes, record-breaking athletes, some of them said to me, well, the sport that I'm doing, I was never interested in. I didn't want to do it. It's something I wasn't interested in taking part in. So I kind of want to find out a little bit about how you got into the sports that you got into, even if it was before Paralympics GB, you know, before you reached the elite level. Dan, how did you get yourself into sport?
So I entered sport as an able-bodied athlete, and that was, I was the age of 11. I just got to secondary school, and once a year you get to do athletics. And so we were throwing the discus, doing a bit of the shot, and throwing the javelin. And I was like the third best in my class at the javelin. And so the teacher took the first two and said, look, you know, you should go to a local club, you know, and pursue javelin throwing. And I was listening in on this conversation, and I thought, you know what, I fancy a bit of that. And ever since that moment, I went to the athletics center, and I used to get picked on quite a lot with my neon ginger hair and glasses, you know. I was the pick of the playground. And after that, sport really saved me. It grew my confidence and almost became my identity. And then I was working up towards the Olympic Games in 2012. And that's when I broke my medial collateral ligament in my elbow. And that was a big, big injury. So that stopped me in my tracks. And at that point, I knew I had retinitis pigmentosa. And when I got diagnosed at the age of 6, they told my parents that I may go fully blind by my mid-20s. And so I had a decision to make. Do I carry on and pursue javelin throwing, or do I see the rest of the world with my usable eyesight? And I took the latter, and I never looked back with regrets. And when my eyesight got really bad and I didn't feel comfortable doing the jobs that I was doing abroad, I decided to come back to the UK. And lo and behold, somebody said to me, why don't you pick up sport again? And why not para sport? And so I got classified, and my life hasn't been the same since. It's been an incredible journey. Just from that one little inkling of passion shown in that one PE lesson.
You must think back to that and go, yeah, I was third and you picked those two and told them to go for it. And look at me now. Eliza, what about you? I know we mentioned about you going along to the swimming lessons. Was that it for you? Was that swimming straight away, or were there other sports you were interested in?
Well, we went to 2012 to watch the London Games. So Scarlett and I were 7 at the time. And then Mum and Dad wanted to see what sports the VI athletes did. So we watched judo and athletics and swimming. But at the time, I was like, not really sure about sport. But then Mum persisted, and she was like, oh, we'll do swimming because it's a life skill, we're safe around water. So we went to our local leisure centre for learn to swim lessons. And then we had a swimming instructor who was like, oh yeah, let's give it a go. And we did that. And then she said, let's give competitive swimming a try. So we tried the 2015 British Blind Sports Youth Swimming Gala, because this is a nice introduction to competitive swimming, because it's low level gala, but you could, in, everyone's really supportive. It's a nice environment. So we tried that, and I think Scarlett may have got a medal in a relay, I think. And she was like, yes, I'm definitely taking this forward. I got a medal. And so I was like, well, if you're doing it, I'll do it too. And we got signposted to our local club, Northampton Swimming Club. And we went through their learn swim still, and then went through their competitive structure. And from then on, we were like, yes, because we're very, very competitive with, between each other. So we're like, yeah, it was just suited us because we could compete individually against the clock, against ourselves, but also against each other as well.
Oh, well, there you go, Scarlett. So you won a medal, and that was you sold on swimming by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, I couldn't really swim at the time. It was just I was there and I did a length. They asked Mum, one of us, to go in the relay. She picked me because I was less tired. And I got a medal. I was like, yeah, that's fine. Absolutely brilliant. Eliza's a bit sad she didn't get picked because it probably would have been her getting a medal instead. I think it was the rest of the team, not me. But I think it's also because, yeah, swimming, as Eliza said, is a life skill. So most parents want their child to learn to swim anyway. And also we didn't have any accessible sports clubs around us, or we didn't know of any where to go to for us to get into sport. And we're both of us needing support because both of us being low vision anyway. And there's only one in Mum, because we have a brother who would also need attention. So we was like, well, I need to do something where she can help both of us. So we just, yeah, swimming happened to be one where we could be supported. And I always say that water, it gives you, like, the swimming gives you freedom because you're enclosed in a box full of water. You can't really go anywhere, and you're enclosed with lane ropes, so you can navigate your way up and down in a straight line. So unlike land, where there's loads of obstacles and you can go on forever, you're stuck in a small area and you can go in a straight line, which you have control over whereabouts you are. So I always say swimming gives me that freedom that on land doesn't.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio's post-Paralympic celebration, recorded in front of a live audience at the Grimaldi Building in London.
I'm going to talk a little bit later about, you know, the sort of importance of sport and what you can get from that. But sticking on the professional side of it for you guys, Dan, how do you fit the training around everyday life?
Well, I'm lucky to be funded by the National Lottery and the players. So, you know, financial worries aren't too much at the moment. So I managed to dedicate, you know, pretty much my whole week to training, which I'm so grateful for. I actually studied to be a sports massage therapist at the Royal National College for the Blind, and I live in Hereford. So, I probably do maybe 5 to 6 massages a week. And that keeps me steady, I think. But I'm very fortunate to be a funded athlete, and that is an incredible thing to have on our side.
Eliza, what about you? Lots of training involved in there as well. I mean, I know you guys are 19 years old at the moment, but I'm assuming you have to. Does the swimming work around everything else? Is everything built around the swimming for you?
So we train 17 and a half hours in the pool, and then have 2 gym sessions. So yeah, that's quite a lot of hours. And then we've just finished our A-levels. We didn't finish them in 2023. So juggling that around school was quite challenging. But yeah, it was good. School were very good at that. So we trained sometimes before school, then had training after school. So those are long days. But then once we finished our A-levels, we had a gap year to focus on swimming this year. And so that worked out nicely because you could train, then go back to bed, and then train again in the evenings. So I think we've been fortunate that the school were very accommodating with when we're training with when we're in school, and then to have the gap year after A-levels worked out really, really nicely. And then we're lucky that we have some lottery funding as well, so that also helps as well. But yeah,
Scarlett, some real dedication, especially I'm thinking around things like A-levels. You know, for some of the guys, they're fully funded. For some, you know, maybe doing it around some work as well. You guys were doing your A-levels. That's a tough enough time for any teenager.
Yeah, fitting it around A-levels and homework is quite a lot. I think you have to be quite disciplined and good time management to get your homework done. We did a lot of our homework at lunchtimes or straight after school at poolside at galas, things like that. So we got it done. I don't know how. There was a few tears involved. But our gap year fell in the Paralympic year, so we could give the trials our best shot and not have any other worries, and we could commit everything up till then.
David, a lot of support for people in the professional part of this as well. But I suppose there's an important thing as well, I think, for getting involved in sport and getting involved in activities for anyone who is blind or partially sighted.
Absolutely. You know, when I was working here, we started the See Sport Differently campaign, and it's been brilliant to, in my first year at Paralympics GB, come up with the Equal Play campaign, and nothing made me more proud than seeing all of our athletes in front of the Agitos yesterday on Sunday before they left the village, doing the equal sign in front of the Agitos, because it's about time that disabled people had access to sport in the same way as anyone else does. If anyone's seen the film we did, Equal Play, with Hannah Cockcroft and Tammy and Marley, who's told their story about lack of access to sport in school, you know, it's on one level it's heartbreaking, on another level it's incredibly annoying. And so we were really buoyed and heartened by the approach that the Prime Minister took and the Secretary of State for Sport took this week in supporting what we're trying to do. And now it's time to make sure that every disabled child has access to sport and PE in school. You know, currently 3 out of 4 don't. And Hannah Cockcroft in our film spoke very honestly about being in being what she described as a classroom full of clothes, while all her fellow pupils had gone off to do PE, and she was left there. Can you imagine a situation where Hannah Cockcroft had missed out on sport forever? You know, all the medals she's won, all the world-class performances she's done. And that might not have happened unless it was due to a random conversation. So, you know, it's really, really important. It's brilliant that the National Lottery and through our world-class programs are funding our athletes to be successful across Olympics and Paralympics. It's brilliant that UK Sport, via the government and the National Lottery, are funding our national governing bodies who are helping bring these athletes forward. But if we don't have equal access to sport in school and equal access to sport in society, then the pipeline is going to dwindle. And it's not just about being at the elite end and the talent end. It's about what sport brings at the grassroots level. And if anyone out there is wondering where to look for accessible sport, look no further than everybodymoves.org.uk. And I'm pleased to say thanks to Channel 4 and thanks to the promotion of Everybody Moves through the Paralympic period, we've now got over 30,000 inclusive sport opportunities on there from around 15,000 before we started. So, yeah, really, really important now.
And when you think about access to sport as well, for many athletes with a range of disabilities, it's not as if it's going to take a lot of capital investment or funding to make sports more accessible. And, you know, if you look at blind or partially sighted people, making a sport accessible can be as little as just training staff. You know, you're not talking expensive equipment or big change, structural changes to buildings. It can just be attitudinal changes and some training.
Well, particularly in education, you know, we're calling for, you know, for starters, let's include it in teacher training. You know, teachers, teaching unions, teaching providers are well up for this. You know, they want to learn about this during teacher training and how to run inclusive lessons, and particularly inclusive PE lessons. We also want sport to be considered a key part of the curriculum. For too long, sport's been put on the sidelines for everybody, and we're really pleased that the government are now putting sport and culture at the heart of the curriculum in their curriculum review. And then teachers need the tools and resources. We can't expect teachers just to know how to do it. And as you say, Al, it's not that difficult to change lessons to be inclusive, but people do need to be taught how to do it and have the resources and tools. And then finally, it was a real pleasure to have Hannah Russell, a visually impaired swimming Paralympian, who's now a primary school teacher, join us out in Paris to talk about this. Because our research shows that only about 0.5% of all teachers would identify as having a disability. Is it any wonder we're not getting this right in the classroom when the amount of lived experience in the classroom is so limited?
Coming back to the athletes and kind of staying on the importance of sport and activities in general. So, you know, Dan, perhaps for blind and partially sighted people, not perhaps making it to the elite level, although we hope some of them will, of course. But the importance that and the things that people can get from being in sport, you know, not just the physical fitness, but perhaps the sort of mental health, the building spatial awareness, your social circle, that there's a lot more that can come from getting that opportunity and having those accessible activities.
Yeah, I think I can speak personally about myself living with a degenerative condition like retinitis pigmentosa, is that it's always changing, right? So my eyesight never stays the same from 1 year to the next. So I'm constantly adapting and changing the way that I do things, whether I realize it or not. And so what this enables me to do is be incredibly adaptable at playing sport, you know? So when things hit the fan, I was about to swear then, but caught myself.
Well, before 9 o'clock.
Yes. you know, I'm able to adapt on a dime, you know? And I think that's the great thing about, I guess, what my impairment gives me, because as much as it takes away, it gives a lot. So I think we are at an advantage to play sport. And, you know, I think if we're given the chance to do so, like we're saying here from Dave, giving teachers the opportunity to understand how to involve people with disabilities in sport, I believe that, you know, we can do incredibly well. And, you know, we're looking towards LA now. And, you know, if we can do this now, incredible, it'll be amazing how many athletes come through from this movement. I'm really, really excited about it. It's going to be an incredible next 4 years.
We spoke with Stephen Clegg a couple of times out there in Paris. And one of the things that he said to us was, you know, similar to yourself, Dan, and probably for yourself, Eliza and Scarlett, that as his eyesight deteriorated, he, you know, his social circle declined. He was staying in more. He said, I think it was, he found himself in a very dark place. And it was just trying sport that brought that confidence back and completely changed his life. I don't think he even thought at that time he'd be a Paralympian. But the fact that sport and activities and just getting out there and doing something, you know, completely changed his life. Eliza, is swimming kind of done that for you?
Yeah, definitely. Sport, you meet so many people. So it really opens up different social circles, different community feels. So we were lucky that we were included in school in our PE lessons. So that meant that we could do PE with our classmates, which was really, really nice. Some of our classmates acted as like the running guides for us. That was really, really nice because then they could see that we were doing it. So obviously a vision impairment didn't have to be a barrier because there were ways to adapt it to include everyone.
Scarlett, so do you think the swimming has helped you gain confidence getting out and about?
You have to learn like self-advocacy skills to tell people what you may need help with, or also you can do for yourself. You also get confident in yourself to ask people for help. I know before I went away with Aquatics GB back in 2022, I would never have dreamed of asking for help because I was just trying to find the answer myself. But now I've realised it's not a failure to ask.
Dan, there are blind and partially sighted people out there who they don't want to try something because they think they can't do it or they won't get the help and support to do it. I mean, how do you think you would encourage those people to just try something?
Yeah, I think it's because you know, like Stephen and myself, like we don't look blind, right? So and the perception of what a visually impaired person looks like, nobody really knows. So I think it's the public's understanding of visual impairment is people just don't know what it is. I've said to people, oh, I'm visually impaired. Sorry, you what? I have to explain what that is. And my eyesight is really hard to explain anyway. So I think it's about bringing awareness to what being visually impaired is. And I know I'm going to make sure that I tell as many people, you know, through the platform that I've got now what it is. And I think that will give people who have visual impairments a lot more confidence to actually speak out a little bit more and actually ask for help, because at the end of the day, that's all it is. And if somebody's going to turn around and say they're not going to help you do something, then just ask the other person, because that person's not really the person you want to be with anyway.
Eliza, it's the same thing for you. You know, you're early into your career. You've done yourself and Skyler have done so much in terms of trying sports. So how would you encourage someone to take that step?
I would say definitely just give sport a go. Try a range of sports and find out which one you enjoy and which one like works for you. And like try any sport, because there will be a way of adapting it. So even if it's not one that you think that people would normally do if they have a vision impairment, then just give it a go and speak to people who have done it, if you know someone who's done it, and see how they've adapted it. Then also there can be different ways to adapt the sport, so whatever works for you, but definitely try a range of them. Don't be afraid to try it.
What about you, Scarlett? What's your advice?
Yeah, I definitely say try a range of sports. Say yes to every opportunity you get, and ask around if you need inspiration on how to adapt things, because there's always a way to adapt most things in the world of vision impairment. So don't be put off by anything, and do what you enjoy. So if you enjoy football or running around, then find a sport that encompasses what you enjoy, because there'll be a way to adapt it. You just need to find that way.
Dan, you brought your medal with you. Has your security got a hold of the medal at the moment?
Well, yeah, my security is Martina. She's always, where's your medal?
It's an impressive piece of metal. I think there's even fragments of the Eiffel Tower in there as well.
Yeah, so at the front of the medal, you've got an octagon, which I believe reads Paris 2024. And that's like a plate that's actually made from the iron from the Eiffel Tower. And then around that, you've got the rest of the circular medal, which has almost like a raised depiction of like a rays from a sun, I believe. That's the way I see it anyway. And then on the back, you're actually seeing the underside of the Eiffel Tower looking up, if you were to stand underneath of it looking up. So you can see it's a really quite a striking image. In the middle of that, where the top of the Eiffel Tower would be, you have the Agitos sign, which is all raised. So, you can feel the Agitos sign. And then either side, I've asked what it means in Braille, and I believe, because I can't read Braille, Paris 2024. On the underside, it has the category which I competed in, and a notch on the side, I believe. I think it's just one notch, which indicates that it is a gold medal.
Very accessible. Well described. What, Dan, is next for you?
Well, what's next for me is, I'm really excited to be here today for the people in the room to try to give me messages and also the tools to go on and use the platform that I've got at the moment, because the amount of media that has approached me is really overwhelming. And I would like to do the best job possible for my community and actually bring awareness to visually impaired people and be the person who represents them.
Do you get a break now from the training, or have you got anything, championships coming up?
So I'm going to have a month and a half off. I'm going back to Sardinia, where my wife is from, and that's where we got married last year. So we'll be going there to celebrate our one-year wedding anniversary, and also to go to another wedding.
Eliza, what about you? What's next? Have you got any competitions on the horizon, or are you thinking about education as well?
So we have about between 4 to 8 weeks off. I'm not really sure yet. And then we then start just back building up fitness and stuff before main gala start early part of next year. But the aim for next year will be to try and qualify for Singapore, so the World Championships in Singapore. Outside the pool, that will be looking at universities and different uni courses, and then hopefully apply for September 2025.
Ah, what about you, Scarlett? Is that a similar thing for you, or you get eyes on something else?
I've got this 4 to 8 weeks off as well. I'm not sure I'm going to do it yet, but yeah, enjoy the time out of the water anyway. And then build towards the qualifying window for Worlds next year. And we want to try and raise the profile of VI sports in this gap year as well. We've never really been into social media, but this year going into the games, they're like, we'll try and raise our profile. So actually it's quite nice that lots of people reached out to ask questions about VI swimming.
David's LA on the horizon and Australia beyond that. Mm-hmm. Is that the focus now for you?
So all eyes are on LA in terms of setting up our athletes to be best prepared and to give of their best out there. But we're very much into the operational side of Milan Cortina. Look forward to the whole RNIB Connect Radio gang coming out to the mountains and seeing each other do an interview on snow, Al. That'll be fun. But we're already thinking about Brisbane as well. So we're starting to have early conversations about that. It's a really interesting sort of life cycle of the games. You've always got three or four things on the go. And Matt will love this. Someone tried to tell me it's a bit like being a retailer. You know, if anyone's heard Matt speak before, he's always talking about his retail days. And so you've got your products on the shelves, you've got your products in the warehouse that are coming onto the shelves, you've got your products in early design. And I think they're quite right, because we've got, you know, Paris just done. That's been sold. We've got Milan Cortina operationally coming into focus, working to the latter stages of working out what's going to happen in LA, and then we got eyes on Brisbane as well. So it never stops at Paralympics GB.
Absolutely. Now, it's time for some Q&As, but I want to throw out a question, actually. It's not to the guys on this panel. Jonathan Penny is in the audience with us tonight, and Jonathan is the Access Services Manager for Channel 4. And Channel 4 were massively involved in the Paralympics this year, as they have been in para sports. You'd audio description on so many things this time. You'd subtitles and captioning and so on. So I'm just interested to know, how successful was it all, and how did it all work?
Hi, yeah, thanks. Hi, everyone. Thanks. Great to be here, Alan. I think, you know, I feel like I'm going to extend Eliza's sporting metaphor from earlier and talk about yesterday as my sort of cool down from the Paralympics coverage. We're just entering the point now where we're going to start kind of reflecting on it all and analysing it and seeing what worked and what didn't. I just wish I had a coach to help me through that as well. But yeah, really delighted with the level of accessibility and our sort of coverage of the games this time around. More kind of audio description, more sign language than we've ever done on any of our previous coverage before. I'll talk a bit about the ADs, obviously particularly relevant for today, but previous games we've sort of focused on next day repeats, you know, doing audio description on that, whereas this year we've been really delighted to take advantage of some technological advancements to bring live audio description to the game, to our games coverage for the first time. I think as well, you know, working with RNIB, with a couple of people from your broadcast team as well, to actually extend some descriptive commentary training to our some of our TV commentators as well, so that, yes, we're offering audio description, but also we're working with the main commentators be able to be a bit more inclusive and make their commentary a bit more accessible as well. And we're delighted, you know, the number of kind of on-air campaigns like Everybody Moves that David mentioned, using that sort of platform of the TV coverage to make everybody aware of the kind of opportunities for disability sport in their area as well. So yeah, really delighted with how our coverage has gone.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. So if anyone has a question, if you want to stick your hand up, we've got a roving microphone.
Thanks. Hi. It's more a question for Eliza and Scarlett. I'm interested in the sibling rivalry that you mentioned. So does that still really fuel your competition?
Yeah, definitely. Very, very competitive. So there's definitely sibling rivalry. I think it gives motivation in the pool to train harder, because, yeah, you ultimately don't want to be beaten by the other one. But we're very supportive as well. So outside the pool, we're very supportive and make sure each other, like, want the best for each other. Then when it comes to racing, yeah, we're super competitive. But yeah, we train together in the same lane, so you can see what the other one's doing. It's a good spying mission. Assuming there's only one winner, so you want to be the winner. In both our finals in Paris, we were in the lanes next door to one another, so that was really lovely. We're competitive because you're right next door, so you know exactly where they are. You're on the same lane rope. But also, it was super special in both our finals to be in the lanes next to one another, because you're on the biggest stage, in the biggest race of your life, with your twin sister. So that's just, yeah, it's lovely.
Any more questions from our audience?
Hi, Alan. My question's for David. Hi, David. It's Thea from RNIB. It's a two-pronged question. So was your first Paralympic Games as CEO. What would you say was the hardest thing about being CEO, and what was the most enjoyable thing about being in your first games?
I think the hardest thing is the complexity. I don't think anyone has any idea the level of complexity that goes into getting 650 people there and back with the performances of their lives. I spent a week at the Chef de Mission seminar in Paris last August and receiving presentation after presentation from 7 a.m. till 10 p.m. at night around security, around venue management, around competition, around air conditioning, around anything you can ever imagine. And this is, it's just the most complex event. You know, some people say the art of great leadership is to employ good people. And certainly did that because our teams are so steeped in this. But the level of complexity, that's the hardest bit. And athlete experience is at the heart of it. Safety and safeguarding and security is at the heart of it. But most of all, we've just got to give our athletes the best opportunity to perform. And that's super hard, but very enjoyable when you do it. The most enjoyable bit, I think I kind of rolled over from ultra stressed to ultra happy somewhere between 3 days out from the opening ceremony when I knew that most people had got there and when the sport actually started. Because literally in the build up, you know, you've got daily reports coming at you of where we're at with stuff. You know, as you might imagine, underneath that swan-like look on top of the lake, there's legs and arms fighting all over the place to make it happen below that. So I moved into that kind of happy space around the opening ceremony. And my favorite moment of the entire games was at the tennis at Roland Garros, and in an absolutely packed out stadium, you could not get another person in there. And from the top of the stands, right from the rafters, this lady shouted out in one of the quiet spaces, "I love you, Alfie." And I just thought, wow, that just reminds me of Wimbledon with, you know, Federer or Agassi or Murray. And it's just a beautiful moment. But there's so many. It was a joyous thing to be part of. But getting there is hard work. And I am very fortunate to have a superb team who make it happen.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. I've really, really enjoyed listening to you. This is a question for, let's say, all four athletes on the panel. I work for a company that run about 100 leisure centres around the country. If I was to sit you guys down with our head project manager and give you 30 million quid on day one of building a new leisure centre, what would be on your list of things to include to make sure that is as accessible a facility as it could possibly be?
Dan, we'll start with you.
I'm glad you've asked that question because at my gym just recently, when COVID was happening, our gym extended into a hall. And in that hall, the ground was actually like a bluey-greeny colour. And all the black equipment was put on that surface. And it was great. I could see everything. Everything stood out. There was contrast between machinery, between a black dumbbell and that floor. And now they just renovated it without telling me. I mean, my club really looks out for me and they were so sorry about doing this because it changed my total training environment. But what they've done is they put down a black rubber floor. There was black squat racks and they painted the walls black as well. And there were mirrors and then strip lighting over the top. And I went in there and nearly cried because it was the start of the Paralympic year, and I thought, how am I going to start training in this? You know, I could literally just, you know, walk on the floor and bang, twist my ankle and my dream is over. So that is really important to have contrast, especially with machinery and the ends of barbells that are hanging out of squat racks. If we can make them, you know, stand out so we're not hitting our head doing these types of things, or even making accessible corridors where gym equipment is laid out. So I would love to have a talk to you guys and make that more accessible environment for visually impaired and blind people. It'd be awesome.
I'd say like textured flooring and stuff. So like when you've got racks, it's like raised or wooden flooring, which is different to the flooring around the racks. And also like at some of the pools we have, which I think we should have in other places as well, is they have lines, like textured lines, raised lines, which also may have high contrast. around in the middle of walking spaces, so you can follow the lines. You're not going to bang into anything. So I find that the texture differences to the ground, and if you can incorporate contrast into that for vision impaired users, so I think that would work quite well.
Eliza, have you got something for us?
Yeah, I think generally just contrast and like keeping things tidy, so maybe areas to put dumbbells and stuff like that, so that the walkways are clear, because then it just makes life easier for everyone.
David, what about you?
Well, the starting point is you're asking the question. That's brilliant. For me, there's lots of stuff around IFI and accessible equipment. For me, it's getting on a treadmill and being able to use it. Normally, I've got a guess that I'm going to keep pressing until it starts. So, you know, having that IFI stuff where it's got raised markers, where you know it's the start-stop button, then you know it's the faster and slower button and that kind of thing. But I think there's probably a bigger cultural point. Many people, when they're brave enough to come out of their house, they're brave enough to get on a bus, they're brave enough to get through the door, and then they turn around because the reception they get at the reception desk, or what can't be done, or how difficult it's going to be, or no, sorry, no one's here to do that today, that's what turns them off. And I think for me, if you can get a culture across your business where people are happy to ask, you know, it's great to have you in here today, can we just confirm, how can we best help you access the centre? What can we do? And be super positive around that. You'll probably find actually that in the long run, as the girls have said, you know, you get that kind of you get to know your way around. You get to know where you're going. You get to need less help. But just that opening and that warmth and that fact that you are absolutely welcome here will encourage people to keep coming back. And I know that, you know, the workforce can be relatively transient around the fitness industry and around sport. But if you can just make that as important as your health and safety, or if you can make that as important as your hygiene stuff in your cafes, or if you can make it just super important, then, you know, it'll make all the difference.
And that is where we're going to bring our fireside chat to an end. And I think we should just round it off really quickly by, first of all, thanks to the audience for coming along tonight. And if we could have a round of applause for our guests, it would be absolutely fantastic.
This was RNIB Connect Radio's post-Paralympic celebration, recorded in front of a live audience at the Grimaldi Building in London. Our immense thanks go to Dan Pembroke, Eliza Humphrey, Scarlett Humphrey and David Clark, as well as everyone in the audience for making the event an evening to remember.